I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. And this is our last call, our last conversation from Calabash, the International Literary Festival on Treasure Beach in Jamaica. A reggae aesthetic threads together a lot of the prose and poetry at Calabash every year. Bob Marley's music and lyrics set that background sensibility, that steamy mix of spirituality and all the physical senses with messages of social urgency and celebration. This year, Barack Obama, too, stands curiously in the background of many a reading and conversation at Calabash. I don't know how many people I heard say things like, "I never thought that I would live to see the Berlin Wall fall down." Or more often they'd say, "I never thought I would see the day when Nelson Mandela walked free in South Africa. And I never thought I'd see a black man nominated for president in the United States." So the suspense of the Obama moment in America touches this gathering of writers in the West Indies. And for many of the writers I interviewed at Calabash, the Obama moment in America has implications that are artistic as well as political. The poet Yusuf Komunyakaa made the literary link with Obama this way. "I think it has everything to do with possibility," he said. The writer is definitely a dreamer. So I asked a number of the writers at Calabash to fill in that connection between Barack Obama politics back in the States and the stories and poems and dreams being read out to a couple of thousand listeners on a beach in the Caribbean in this late spring of 2008. I begin with Lorna Goodison, a very popular novelist in Jamaica who has taught for many years in Canada and at the University of Michigan.
In all the years that I've been in the Midwest, and I went there first in 1991, I have never seen the level of engagement and excitement with politics as I've seen in this election. I have had students come to me and say, "I'm not coming to class, I'm going to work for Barack, and you can do what you want." You know? I've never, ever seen that. And I think that, obviously, that is something that it would be a real sin if that youthful enthusiasm and drive and verve and engagement, you know, it just went away, you know. So I think whoever wins should, they should be able to tap into this moment where the young people are interested again and wanting to participate. I went to art school in New York in 1968, and that was a time, it feels a little like the 60s again, which I thought would never, which I would never ever see, which I just find it has to be good.
Is there a Jamaican perspective on all of this?
On Barack?
Yeah.
Well, of course, well, I mean, obviously we would all love Barack, but It's not just because he's black, you know. He's very cool. He's cool. I think anybody who likes cool would like him. He's an extraordinarily cool guy.
And handsome. You know? And beautifully
dressed. But
he's
not even handsome, but he's just cool. Even if he weren't well dressed, the way he responds to things, the way he's cool. And I personally like that. I applaud him for his cool. His cool. He could always be a jazz musician. He's cool. Okay, let me go back to the classroom again. I teach at the Center for African and African American Studies. I've been teaching for the past 10 or so years a West Indian literature course. But what I do is that if I see that it just turns into a course on poetry and some fiction. Because if I see my students really engaged by or gravitating towards a certain kind of thing in a poem, I will go and find anything I think to reinforce that interest and give it to them. I teach football players, I teach all kinds of people who hate poetry and they think poetry sucks. And my idea is, the object of the exercise is to change their minds, to convert them. I do a whole section on like poems about stereotypes, for example. And John Agard has a poem about the Palm Tree King, you know that one? Because I come from the West Indies, certain people seem to think I'm an expert on palm trees. So then he really just, you know, messes with them, you know. "I am the Palm Tree King and I know palm tree like the palm of my hand," and, you know. But all I'm saying is that I sense in my students a need to be seen for who they are, and that my sense is that people really want this business of just, you know, stereotyping people or putting people into categories willy-nilly because of how they look, how they sound, you know. It's just something that the world seems to be really tired of or they want to break out of. And I think maybe that explains something about Barack, because Barack has defied a lot of these stereotypes. Mm. Although, I think, as Derek said the other day, the day when a black man can be vilified for being elitist in the United States of America is a great day. That's a wonderful jubilee. It's a great day, you know. So I don't know if that makes any sense to you. I think that is my reading of it.
Laura Goodison, it's a great pleasure to hear you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thomas Glave is a Jamaican writer who teaches in the States, starting at MIT in the fall. He has just edited an anthology of gay and lesbian writing from the Antilles. Thomas Glave, let me ask, how does the Barack Obama moment impress itself on the literary world that you're part of here in the Antilles, in Jamaica, and all the English-speaking Caribbean islands?
Well, I can speak for myself and say that I think, at the very least, this is a big issue, actually, it impacts powerfully on the imagination, which is where we begin, right? Because the very idea of something unthinkable, which is that there could be a black man in the United States White House, right, is already in itself an enormous proposition, and that charges the imagination, certainly charges my imagination, to begin thinking of many other things, like what else might be possible, right, in the United States. But it also, I think, stokes faith that actually people can change and people actually can be accountable to one another as human beings, and that perhaps racism and ethnocentrism and bigotry are not always intransigent forces, that actually people really can change. And that gives me more faith in human beings. I think that's the way one has to live, and I think that this moment provides an example of that. But I think that Barack Obama himself believes that. Otherwise, I don't think that he would be able to represent himself the way that he has, you know? I think that he himself sees the possibility of change and faith in humanity because he has put himself forward as a very sincere politician. And I think that's very powerful because I think people believe that from him, looking at him. I mean, perhaps in some ways one might say that he's a bit of an idealist, but that's not necessarily a bad thing for a presidential candidate to be. Because I think he's also a realist, too. Even the idea of saying President Obama. Remember, of course, that the United States president is in many ways metaphorically a god, you know, an actual god, godhead. So to have a black god in your church, in your supreme cathedral, is really in God we trust. And by extension, if it's not George Washington, it's Barack Obama.
Thomas Glave, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to hear you on Open Source. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris.
The poet Kwame Dawes wrote the book, literally, on the reggae aesthetic. He thinks of himself as the busiest man in literature today, and he's all over the globe. Born in Ghana, schooled in Jamaica, now a professor at the University of South Carolina, and not yet 50 years old. He spoke about the range of reggae meanings in the world on his way to defining this Obama moment for the United States and the rest of the planet. Kwame Dawes, you're the very model of the modern global writer. Ghana, Jamaica, and now South Carolina in your file. Active, prolific, all over the place. I want to know how it feels.
It doesn't feel global. It feels deeply rooted. Part of what has been true about my experience is that wherever I've landed, I've found ways to find roots and to plant roots. I think because I've moved a bit, I've always sought quickly. I'll be like one of those plants that evolves into an organism that needs to quickly grow roots that can hold onto the soil. And it turns out that they're not so hard. I mean, South Carolina is is, as far as I'm concerned, the most Caribbean of the states of the United States. Yes, people would say Miami or Louisiana, but I think it's I think it's South Carolina, largely because of the Gullah community, largely because of the racial population of South Carolina, which is something like almost 50% of the population is African American, and nowhere else in the states has those kinds of numbers. Consequently, the culture is reflected in that kind of way, and the Gullah people on the East Coast, the Low Country, speak like Caribbean people. They use the dialect. They use lexical items that are actually unique to that area, but connect with Caribbean dialects and so on. And then, you know, I grew up with the global media, learning about America and African American history. I had a father who was a Marxist and a Pan-Africanist and so on. So seeing big images of Angela Davis, posters of Angela Davis in my home was how I grew up. We had images of Martin Luther King and so on. And so I don't feel terribly global in that sense, although obviously I am. I mean, I feel myself connected to Jamaica. I see myself connected to Ghana. But it doesn't give me a crisis of identity or place at all.
No, it gives you the multiplicity of angles that we all covet. But I wonder, how do you set your sort of moral and intellectual, even your poetic agenda, knowing as much as you do about so many stages?
Yeah, I think I've sought to do that. I think I've sought to do that in many different ways. First, there's family. My father was a Marxist and obviously a gifted intellect. My mother is an artist and a Ghanaian and a social worker. So those, I think, are part of my grounding of what is valuable. I mean, it's to question authority in the sense of suspecting its motives. It's to question the way that media articulates information and so on. So that forms a certain way of viewing the world, but it's also the empathetic side of me that I think grows out of my mother, who works with people and has that intense connection with people. Then there's the spiritual dimension, which I think forms your foundation, because one of the sort of big ruptures in my growing up was when I became Christian, and my father thought, you know, what are you doing? And there was this time when we had to have the talk to discuss, you know, what, am I betraying him? Am I betraying everything he thought he taught me? But that became tied to my connection with reggae, which forms my aesthetic basis, my aesthetic understanding. And it's a sophisticated engagement with reggae music as a kind of grounding that I know as an artist I need. And Colin Channa, who, you know, works with, you know, we work together with Calabash, and I have a saying that always turn to reggae if you're in a crisis, an aesthetic crisis, to see what the answer is. And we when people would say, what would Jesus do? We'd say, what would reggae do? And it's funny, but there are some real issues of cosmology. There are issues of artistic engagement and the ideas of what they represent. And there's also a confidence that comes with this connection with what I think is a tremendous modern phenomenon.
Can I ask, if there was a single headline of my impressions at Calabash 08, it's that the reggae aesthetic lives in a very big way, but remind me what we're talking about.
It does, and I think it's good that you recognize that. It's impossible to reduce the reggae aesthetic to a simple discussion of this nature. I teach whole courses on it, but reggae music achieves a remarkable thing. It manages to be at once a deeply spiritual music. That is a music that is rooted in Rastafarian belief systems, that has a strong Pan-Africanist sensibility and a strong sort of engagement with Judeo-Christian ideas, but breaking those ideas and turning them into an Afrocentric series of ideas. So it has its own cosmology and therefore its own spiritual dimensions. It manages to articulate that. And at the same time, it manages to articulate political sensibilities and political sensitivity, and in that sense, it speaks to the present. It speaks to the experience of the present. It finds a language with which to articulate what the present is, and then at the same time, it is able to have a historical groundedness. That is, that it roots its meaning and connections within a larger history and an understanding of the history of a people, and all of this is going on at the same time. And then, of course, on top of that, it is fundamentally a sensual music of visceral, passionate response. It is about dancing. It is about sex. It is about the body. It's about all of these things. And so in one reggae lyric, you can get all of these elements contained in it. And it seemed to me, discovering this as a young guy sort of engaging Bob Marley's music and other reggae song artists, I began to think that if I could write poems that achieve that kind of breath and complexity within the same line and within the same expression of the line, then I'm beginning to find something that I could call an effective aesthetic. And I wanted to find an aesthetic because I knew there was the blues aesthetic, and I knew where that was rooted in and connected to. I knew there was the sun aesthetic, which was for Nicolas Guillen, and the Cuban sun aesthetic. I knew there's the jazz aesthetic, and I knew there was the Irish aesthetic, and I knew there was the Greeks and the Romans, the Enlightenment aesthetic, and so on. And I thought, so what is my fundamental aesthetic and base? And I found it in reggae music.
For instance, when you repair to the reggae aesthetic, what's the tune? What are the lyrics? What's the dance that comes to your mind?
Well, we've got such a wonderful catalog of songs that we can apply to given moments.
For instance,
when I was under siege in my department by a number of my English department at University of South Carolina by attacks on me for sometimes mostly unfounded reasons and so on, I would always walk into my office and play Bob Marley's Demago Tired for Seeing Bad Card. You draw a bad card. The line is translated here. You're going to be tired to see my face. You can't get me out of the race. You know, it's a big disgrace, but you've drawn the bad card, right? And then, I want to disturb my neighbors because I'm feeling so high. I want to turn up my disco and blow them the full watts tonight in rubber dub style. That song was a way of saying, I'm not going anywhere, and you're going to have to deal with me. But I'm going to do it with fun. I'm going to enjoy myself in rubber dub style. And it gave me solace, and it gave me strength, and so on. So, I mean, we could go on and on about that. And that is the way in which we apply reggae aesthetic. But the other thing that we do is you turn to reggae to say, is this reggae like? Is this part of the aesthetic? Does it have the sensual? Does it have the spiritual? Does it have the political sensibility? Does it have the confidence and the assurance of its basic relevance to the world? I mean, one of the things that we look to reggae for is to say, reggae is a profoundly local music, but it has international bearing and impact. Mm-hmm. And it gives you a positioning that says, and this is something that many people in larger countries like the U.S. don't necessarily understand, except if they're located in really regional spaces, and which is that if you come from a place that is a small island like Jamaica with 2.5 million people, maybe 3 million people, you enter the larger world with questions about the extent to which you can have relevance to that world. And when we look at reggae music, the very local presence, that sense of being engaged with the local moment and yet having confidence to have an impact in the wider world and to be so ubiquitous in the larger world, gives you tremendous amount of confidence as an artist and as an individual. And that feeds me as a writer.
It was a great reggae moment when that beautiful little poet from Belarusia looked at and said, I've never seen a sexier audience than I'm looking at tonight.
That is reggae. And she got it. That's the point. She got it. And she knew that saying it is sexy, it's not salacious. It is not... No. But she's saying there's the soul, there's the body, and it's free to be that body. And it's not just almost spiritual, it is spiritual. Mm-hmm. And she gets it, and that's what she was trying to say. That was Valjina Mort from Belarus, a beautiful poet. And that's a reggae moment.
Kwame Dawes, I came to Calabash in a kind of narcissistic American mode, wondering, what is this mirror on our own moment in 2008? What can we see in this very, very penetrating Jamaican gaze about what we're going through? Yeah. At the end of the Bush years, at the in a transition to God knows where, what did you pick up?
I'll tell you what is clear to me, and I obviously I'm following what is happening with Barack Obama and his campaign. I think that's the story. I think we may like to be fair and balanced and pretend that there's another story that is happening, but that's the story. Barack Obama's campaign reflects an incredibly smart structure and organizational principle that has been doing something interesting about galvanizing African American people in ways that are completely underground. And I'll explain that at risk of making a statement that undermines exactly what I think the African American community is trying to do. The African American community has known outward protest and has known the value of that kind of protest. It has also known underground protest, but we've not sort of spoken about it as much because it has been underground. What is happening with the Barack Obama campaign is that African Americans, without even saying it to each other, know that their articulation of support for Barack Obama cannot be loud, because if it is loud, then there is going to be an anxiety in the white population to articulate that as a racial battle. And therefore, they've been incredibly quiet, but they've been voting in dramatic numbers. In other words, there's a galvanizing that no organization has been able to do, and nobody has told them to galvanize, and yet they're galvanizing. And it is because what they see in Obama, what we see in Obama, is not so much that it's now our turn to take over and do something different, but this is long coming. It means that the belief in America, the belief in the American vision of its egalitarian nature, which has been denied for so long, seems close, and that is what is at stake. And how that connects with Calabash for me is what we've done at Calabash. This is the eighth year of a festival that when we first conceived of the idea and put it to people in Jamaica, they all laughed at us and said this would never work because Jamaicans don't read and they won't show up. They don't buy books, which is now proven to be an absolute lie. But we knew they did. And we knew that what we wanted to do is have a brilliantly organized festival and doing it in a shocking way by not charging anybody anything. I think that's the same kind of spirit that says you can make a change in the way that people see themselves and see their society by presenting models of how that can be done exceptionally well.
Let me just say briefly, the impressions I get from here about Barack are, for one thing, there's this kind of just desperately prayerful hope that the man is safe, that the man does well, that the man feels appreciated, and of course that he wins. Then there's at an artistic level, people celebrate this moment of creation, moment of doubt, moment of imagination. What can happen? It's not so different, people keep saying, from writing a poem or conceiving a novel. At another more desperate level, after listening to Derek Walcott, you just wonder, is the arrogance of power and money and empire an incurable condition? Is it something that is so advanced in the American way now, with so little protest, I must say, from media, from Congress, from the writing crowd, in fact, that it's irreversible?
Well, we'll know. This is what we'll find out. I mean, if I would say two things. A win by Barack Obama doesn't necessarily mean everything has changed. All has changed. I don't think that's what it would mean. But I think it would mean something has changed. But power won't change. I don't think Barack Obama will not be an imperialist. I think he probably will be an imperialist. But we can look at models of imperialism and say maybe in the same way that we think that there can be a better way of doing these things, maybe he may represent that. Maybe he is Joseph, you know, in that biblical narrative, which changes the imperial. Or is he Moses who has to get the hell out of Egypt? You know, so there are paradigms that they're called to question. But it is a significant time. I think that there's no question about that.
No question about that. Thank you, Kwame Dawes, so much for this festival and for joining us on Open Source. It's a treat to hear you.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
This non-stop turn and twist. God over his mercy. What's on the turn of a ground? Here, but you want to know. Me all a walk like a champion, talk like a champion. What a piece of money, girl, tell me where you get it from. Knock on your entrance, ram pa pa pam pam. Can't let me in, me have the thing where you are waiting for. Walk like a champion, talk like a champion. What a piece of money, girl, how will you get it from. Knock on your entrance, ram pa pa pam pam. Can't let me in, why? Would you be, would be more than dead to take your hand and lead you to the promised land. Me 20-foot dive on, all you got to do is be true, so let's go. Satisfying your emotion, at a for the press, instantly she was.